This is an ABC podcast.
10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes.
Hi, my name is Jason DeRosso and welcome to The Screen Show. Coming up, the documentary celebrating 50 years since the moon landing, Apollo 11, plus the Hollywood producer who's calling Adelaide home for the next few years as he makes the biggest blockbuster ever seen in South Australia. And TV critic Lauren Carroll Harris will be in to speak about a new series set in Alice Springs by filmmaker Dylan River, the son of Warwick Thornton. It's called Robbie Hood.
Robbie by name, Robin by nature.
But first up to the drama, uncertainty and jubilation of a scientific achievement that took our collective breath away back in 1969, depicted in breathtakingly pristine images in cinemas this week.
I'd like to know what you feel as far as responsibilities of representing mankind on this trip.
That's relatively difficult to answer. It's a job that we collectively said that was possible and we could do. And of course, the nation itself is backing us. So we just sincerely hope that we measure up to that.
This documentary is titled simply Apollo 11. It's a film that uses archival footage, some of it never before seen, and it doesn't have any of the conventional documentary adornments like narration or present-day interviews. It's a meticulously edited film that portrays the times and the mood like it was yesterday. Its visuals pop on screen, the brilliant white of the astronauts' suits, the deep black of space, the tanned buzz-cut scientists sitting at rows of monitors in mission control, and hundreds of thousands making a day of it with card tables and picnic hampers to watch the launch. And the emotion, too, seems to be fresh. Neil Armstrong, the first time you see him in the film, looks to have a flicker of real apprehension on his face. I've actually seen this suiting up footage before, but within context, I'd never seen it with this level of very vivid emotion. Now, Apollo 11 is clearly inspired by the more sprawling 1989 documentary For All Mankind, which was about the entire Apollo program, and it does repeat some of its footage, but Apollo 11 is essentially focused just on the launch and the mission of the lunar landing. It's clearly designed, I think, to evoke awe and enthusiasm for NASA's role in the world. And with the current White House leadership, that mission seems more open to debate than recent times. A cinematic calling card, if you will, that's selling enthusiasm and the promise of concrete achievement that we can all feel warm and fuzzy about. But there is a moment of warning for any politician, Trump or otherwise, who hopes to pin their fortunes to space glory. The film shows Nixon on the TV congratulating the astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, and then cuts to the staff at Mission Control while the TV's on, who seem pretty unenthused with the words from the Commander-in-Chief. Well, I caught up with the film's archival producer, Stephen Slater, to talk me through just what it was like going through all that previously unreleased footage.
Yeah, it's 70 millimeter film, which was a proto IMAX format that they used to film movies like The Sound of Music and Lawrence of Arabia. It was a format called Todd AO were the manufacturers. So, 65 mil, 70 mil would be sort of technical terms for it. And it kind of fell out of favor in the late 60s and early 70s. But it turns out they had, actually it was 165 reels of this stuff just to do with the Apollo program. And a third of that was to do with Apollo 11. And when we heard about it, we thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. We'll have that.
Hold on. I would have thought, with footage shot on that gauge, it would all have been made public because it's such good quality and we would know about it, but not the case.
No, for whatever reason, it just languished in the National Archives in Maryland in cold storage, kept in pristine condition for all these years, and no one knew about it.
So what are some of the images we see in this film, Apollo 11, that are from that particular batch? Because I know that there are other batches of never before seen footage as well that we'll talk about, but of the sort of 70 mil stuff, what are the images in the film that that are completely new?
Well, almost all of the first 30 minutes is scenes shot at Cape Kennedy, either just before or the day of the launch of Apollo 11. And it features scenes such as the crowds arriving on the beach, station wagons and mobile homes and 60s haircuts. And then all the VIP stands, Lyndon Johnson's there, Johnny Carson, who was the Tonight Show, host of the Tonight Show, Isaac Asimov, famous science fiction presenter.
I'm curious about those huge, ginormous tank tracks that we see in one of the earlier shots, if not perhaps the first shot.
Yes, it's the crawler taking the Saturn V to the pad.
It looks like something from Star Wars.
Yes, I mean, yeah.
And because it's so pristine.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you see the guy, there's a guy walking in front of it. You get the sense of the scale compared to the crawler. It's amazing.
Now, what were the other sorts of gauges that you were dealing with in terms of the other archival footage? Because
you're obviously very technical on this show.
We like to be.
Yes. anything shot in space on film is 16mm because the astronauts took 16mm film with them. And then there's, which is kind of my specialist geeky area, is the mission control film. And that was shot on 16mm by guys just shooting B-roll, effectively, for NASA. And I'd seen this film for years and wanted to know...
So
when
B-roll
it was
being
shot.
Sort of stuff that's usually used for cutaways.
I feel like that, yes, or it was filmed for, you know, to be edited into a government film later on. But I'd always seen this and I'd like, I want to know exactly when this was filmed. I want to be in mission control when the Eagle landed. And it turned out that none of this film had any sound. And so me being kind of not having any kind of social life and being a bit crazy, I just decided I wanted to try and add the sound to this stuff. And so I would go through the air-to-ground flight loops where the flight controller, the Capcom is talking to the crew and then try and lip-sync it to the footage.
So hold on. So you've got how much visual footage at this point? How much picture have you got of ground control?
There's probably about 100 reels of film, but it's all very shot in very short bursts. So 100 feet roll of film, 3 minutes per reel.
All of it's mute. And how much audio do you have?
11,000 hours for the whole mission. And that's not only, that's another very long story, but we got access to that specifically for this project. But it was basically all those guys had headsets. And their loop, as it were, was going onto a 30-track recorder. And there's actually 60 channels at any point in the mission that I could have access to go. And so if I can see a guy and I know it's the guidance officer and I know, because I know these things, that he was on shift at a certain time, I can then get the audio and try and lip sync it to him. And
wow.
So anytime you see a controller talking in the film, it's because I've added the sound.
I think this sort of documentary seems to be having a bit of a moment at the moment. I mean, next week we've got the new Maradona film out, which is all archival footage. Recently we've had an Australian film about Michael Hutchence, the lead singer of In Excess, which was also all archival
footage. I'd love to see that,
footage.
Actually.
Well, it's very interesting. A lot of sort of 80s archival footage.
Wow.
Likewise, the Maradona film is very similar as well.
Yeah, I saw that in Sheffield recently, actually.
What do you make of this current moment and this sort of film where it's very rigorous, isn't it? It's only archival footage.
Well, I'm all for it. I mean, the Maradona thing and Amy and Senna, which I'm huge fans of, Asif Kapadia, the director, did those. Amy won the Oscar. It's similar to what we've done with Apollo 11, but where it's different is that they do have retrospective interviews. So we do have people talking about events in the past, even though it's just audio. And I think Apollo 11 is just an immersive film, and you're just it's just everything that happened at the time, the audio that was recorded at the time and the footage from the time.
Yeah, but is there something, do you think, about the appeal of archival that is having a moment at this point in history? Because it strikes me that we have never before been so able to create images ourselves. You know, we've got great cameras in our pockets with our smartphones, for example. So we can shoot anything at any time. Is there something kind of attractive about the archival film wherein these are the limits? This is all we've got. I mean, it might be, as is the case in Apollo 11, a lot of footage, but it is all we've got. We're going to just, you know, constrain ourselves to this footage so that we're, I don't know, is there something about the appeal of being immersed in something that is wall to wall from that era?
Yes, I think so, yeah. And I think it's reminiscent of a time perhaps when production values were higher than they are now. And I can see, I mean, it'll be interesting to know, you know, the footage we're shooting now on our mobile phones and everything, what's going to happen to, where's that going to be preserved? And how's, if someone in 50 years' time wants to do a film about something that happened today, how are they going to access that?
Are they going
material?
To trawl the cloud or something? Are they going to, I mean, how?
Yeah, exactly. It's, but people's, have this mistaken belief that somehow things are easier now we have everything in digital or everything's on YouTube. In fact, it makes my life a lot more difficult in many ways because it's harder to source particularly original material and that kind of thing. But that's a whole other discussion, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and certainly it does raise, I mean, it's a can of worms really, isn't it, as well? The fact that there's no indexality. I mean, these files that we shoot on our smartphones, they're not a support that is materially real. They're sort of ones and zeros in the binary sort of ether.
Yeah. No, and then the other issue that I have is that I think a lot of filmmakers will see something like Apollo 11 or Amy and Senna, and then they'll just say, well, we want to do a film like that. But they don't, all they're seeing is the end product. They don't see how much time it takes to do these things like properly and thoroughly. And, you know, someone will say, well, yeah, I want to do that for, let's say for argument's sake, Apollo 13 in 2 months, you know, or something like that. And,
well, when did you start working on Apollo 11?
Well, the production started in early 2017, but we'd already done a short film about Apollo 17 that had a very similar style that was in 2016. Again, Todd Douglas Miller and myself and Matt Morton, the composer, and Tom Peterson, the producer, we all worked together on that. But then I grounded myself in that archive for many years before that.
Now, tell me about that access, because what's NASA's role in your life? Does NASA employ you, or were you at one point sort of working for NASA in the archives?
No. I just had an interest in having seen these films that were already out there, a lot of which I wasn't very impressed with, but then also making my own films. I mean, I made a documentary about a space probe that landed on a moon of Saturn called Titan, and that really just got me very interested in the archive and finding out the provenance of the archive.
But is it easy to get access to the archive? I mean, how do you sort of go about that?
It's not easy now, and there's a kind of it's misconstrued that NASA material is easily available and it's free and it's for all. Well, it's free in a copyright sense, in that we don't pay licensing fees for it, but getting access to the original materials, like, you know, the 70mm. I mean, we had to design a special scanner. Say, I'm using the Royal We. There was a team in New York who designed a special scanner to deal with the 8K, you know, to scan it at 8K, all that 70mm.
Yes, because it's all been scanned and kind of cleaned up, I imagine. I mean,
yeah, they've done a lot of post work on it, although it was in very good condition anyway.
Yeah, so, well, it certainly looks pristine when you see it, and I think that's one of the things that's just so impactful on you as a viewer. I want to ask you, that shot of Nixon, that television broadcast of Nixon talking to the astronauts.
Yes.
We see that in a wider shot of a few scientists hanging around the TV.
Yes, it's some people watching on the screen in Mission Control.
Was that one of those images that you found, one of the never before seen images?
Yeah, so there is 70mm material shot in Mission Control, and that is one of the reels. Actually, that was some of the worst material technically because it was so underexposed. I don't know what was going on, whether it was to do with the film stock or whether it was just because it was very dark in that room at the time. But it was, we had to do a huge amount of work on that.
What I love about that moment though is that those guys seem to be singularly underwhelmed by the commander in chief at that point. And I just
interesting
sort of think,
you say that. Other people have said that as well.
Well, I just sort of think if any politician is wanting to sort of, piggyback onto some kind of future NASA glory, it's a great little moment for them to see, because it doesn't they can't necessarily bask in that glory.
I think it's a rather nice speech. I don't, far from me to defend Nixon, but he, and we don't ever refer to him by name in the film. He's just known as the president. And then, I mean, if in a kind of where's Wally kind of moment, you see him on the USS Hornet at the end in the crowd, and it's kind of Like, did anyone spot that? Did you see him there? I don't know.
Yeah, but well, I like all of that though. You see, I think that sort of undercuts some of what might have been the pomposity of some of those moments might have been if you'd framed it differently, or if it had been framed differently. So I quite like that underlying sort of tension between what's potentially a grandiose moment or a grand moment and the kind of banality of how it plays out in a certain context. I think
well, he was taking up a lot of time, and what, they had 2.5 hours on the moon, and I mean, yes. Not long.
No. Yeah. Look, it's a fascinating documentary. And before I let you go, have you got one moment that in the film that sticks with you as your favorite moment?
The lunar liftoff, after the lunar module lifted off from the moon, it came into rendezvous with Michael Collins, who was in orbit in Columbia, the command module. And there's just this beautiful sequence in the film where you see the lunar surface going by for about 30 seconds. You don't really know what's going on. And then this small dot just gets bigger and bigger and moves towards you. And it's underplayed by this soundtrack that Matt Morton, our composer's done. And I cried when I saw that the first time. It was just beautiful cinematography and orbital mechanics as it came into rendezvous. That's my favourite scene in the film. But there's many, many others that I'm very fond of.
Orbital mechanics. There's something totally beautiful about orbital mechanics, aren't they, when they go right?
Yes, and there was so much that could go wrong, and it all went right. And people forget what a fragile daisy chain it was for all those things to happen and get those guys home.
Well, Stephen Slater, thank you for playing your part in bringing to our screens once again the wonder of the Apollo 11 mission.
Thank you very much.
That's Stephen Slater, who is the archival producer on Apollo 11, which is a film out this week.
This gorge is where all lions come to find their roar.
All lions? Even my dad?
Even Mufasa came here when he was your age. Refused to leave until his roar could be heard above the rim.
All the way up there?
That's when you know you found it. With a little practice, you'll never be called a cub again.
Watch this.
You'll get it, Simba. Just takes time.
Well, this week's juggernaut of popular entertainment from the corporation that increasingly owns everything, Disney, is a remake of the 1994 animated musical film about a young lion named Simba. Yes, The Lion King. It's about that young lion and his struggle to wrestle back the throne of his kingdom from an usurper, a dastardly uncle named Scar. But not before growing up a little and doing some things that lions in the wild tend not to do, like learning how to frolic peacefully. He's a lion, remember, but frolicking peacefully with other animals is what he ends up learning to do against his nature, you might add. And basically hanging around the savannah and embracing the motto Hakuna Matata, which roughly translates as no worries. Words that you cannot unhear after you hear this.
Hakuna Matata, what a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata, ain't no passing craze.
Okay, now that's from the original. Maybe it's the fact that I haven't seen the original in a long time. But I'm finding myself in a minority of critics on this remake. And that's to say that I admire the feeling and nuance that blockbuster director Jon Favreau has brought to this. I choose my words carefully because a lot of critics are saying that this photorealistic animation is anything but nuanced and has a lack of feeling. And I'm wondering if these critics are seeing the same film as me. I think this is a film that's anything but flat emotionally. I mean, yes, the visual palette is often more washed out, but it's also quite a suitable ploy in certain moments, like where Simba's formerly lush kingdom is turned into a wasteland from a jackal army who have devoured all wildlife with the same gluttonous appetite as the critics and celebrities at the Sydney premiere this week chowing down on the complimentary vol-au-vents. I didn't eat them, but if you're wondering, a waitress told me that they were filled with pulled beef and coconut milk.
Now, the voice work by the likes of Donald Glover as grown-up Simba, Seth Rogen as the adorable bush piggy Pumbaa, Beyoncé as Queen Nala, and Chiwetel Ejiofor as Uncle Scar, who brings Shakespearean-level menace to his scowl, is all good, and the action sequences of close escapes and table-turning twists are thrilling. The uncannily realistic animation, meanwhile, I think, as I've mentioned, has a lot of room for surprising inflections, from joy through to vulnerability and malice. Now, the first film went out of its way to distance the Disney lions from the cruel predators on BBC wildlife documentaries by inventing the circle of life concept. This is the idea that wherever you are on the food chain, even if you're at the top, you're part of a cycle of life and death. And this gave the savannah a dimension of Zen egalitarianism. Trotted out again and looking this photorealistic, the concept does feel a little stretched. I will admit too that it is perhaps a bit of a hard sell these days, making a child's fable that doesn't question this story's inherent hierarchies and privileges. This is, after all, the tale of a prince fighting to regain his station. It's not the tale of some street urchin transcending hers. There's no Cinderella factor, and certainly not even a Moana factor. Nor are there any redeeming qualities to the evil and sometimes comically bungling jackals, a rampaging group living across the border who want to get in and are essentially depicted as greedy. The menacing horde is confronting given the historical moment, though I don't think it excuses the use of an F-word I saw to describe this film this week. Yes, it's a word usually associated with mid-century dictators like Hitler and Mussolini. That's right, I saw someone call this film fascist online. The best F-word I'd use for The Lion King is still fable, and I think it's a vivid one about finding courage to face what looks like an insurmountable challenge. And as for the idea it's just about some privileged royal kid, well, I think actually it's a very workable allegory for most children who live in a world where they believe themselves to be princes and princesses anyway, or at least the centre of their world. It is what it is. It's a film about lions for children, and this adult enjoyed it. And I'll be singing this song for the rest of the day.
Hakuna Matata, what a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata, ain't no passing craze.
Okay, we'll fade out of that massively soon. Okay, you're listening to ABCRN. This is The Screen Show. My name is Jason DeRosso. I'll recompose myself because now I'm about to welcome Claire Nichols, who's here with the latest arts news. Hello, Claire.
Hello, Hakuna Matata.
And Emmy nominations are in.
Yeah, and Game of Thrones leads the pack with 32 nominations for its eighth and final season. That's actually a new record for primetime Emmy nominations for a show in a single year, Jason. Mm. Other shows with multiple nominations include The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Chernobyl, Fleabag, and Veep. And speaking of Veep,
Leon, yeah. I'm not sure about this part where I say I want to be president for all Americans. I mean, do I, you know, all of them?
That's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Now, she's been nominated once again for Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her role as Selena Meyer in Veep. Now, do you know, she's won that prize six times in a row for this role. Mm. She sat out last year while the show was on hiatus as she was treated for breast cancer. Now she's back in the running again. And if she wins, she will set a new Emmy record for the most overall acting wins.
Mm. It's a really strong category this year, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, really, yes. Strong. So this is Best Comedy Actress category. She's up against Christina Applegate for Dead to Me, Rachel Brosnahan for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, of course, that's who won last year, Natasha Lyonne for Russian Doll, Catherine O'Hara for Schitt's Creek, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge for Fleabag. So that's some tough competition.
Yeah, yeah, really big. I mean, okay, so every year there are snubs, of course, as well, and, you know, lots of column inches and, you know, mm-hmm. gets written about the snubs. Who missed out on nominations this year?
Well, yeah, it's hard. I mean, I guess there's always more shows that miss out than make the nomination. But there's a few significant ones I'll mention. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the first time in its running that it hasn't got a single nomination. The Good Fight didn't get a single nomination, despite that show getting a lot of critical acclaim. I'm going to mention The Big Bang Theory because this was once a pretty successful show at the Emmys. And in its final season, it's only received three nominations in what you'd call kind of the more low-profile categories. And it's probably also worth mentioning that big movie star Julia Roberts missed out on an acting nomination after making the move to TV in the series Homecoming.
Are there any Australians in the running this year?
Well, we can cheer for Hannah Gadsby. She's been nominated for Outstanding Variety Special and Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special, both for her Netflix show Nanette. It's actually been a great week for Hannah Gadsby. She won a Helpman Award on Monday. Dana Reid, the Australian, is also in the running for an Emmy for directing an episode of The Handmaid's Tale. And the production designer, Deborah Riley, has been nominated for her work on Game of Thrones. When we started talking, we were saying that Game of Thrones leads the pack this year, Jason, and that means that HBO is back on top when it comes to the nomination count. It has 137 nominations ahead of its rival Netflix, which has 117.
All right. Well, speaking of Netflix, it's made a change to the show 13 Reasons Why. Tell us about that.
So you'll remember this show. It was about teenage suicide. It attracted a fair bit of controversy when it first appeared on Netflix in 2017. And now 2 years later, Netflix has announced that it's gone back and edited that show to remove a graphic suicide scene at the end of the first season. Now, if you're like me, you're probably wondering why it's doing this now, 2 years later.
And when it's there already was, out and yeah, it's interesting.
And there was so much debate at the time. Netflix says it's been mindful of ongoing debate around the show and it's edited the scene on advice of medical experts. I should probably also mention they're about to release a new season, so they're probably expecting a lot of people to go back and rewatch season one.
All right. In other news, now, do we really have a new James Bond?
Well, no, we don't have a new Bond, but according to the Daily Mail in London, there is a new 007. The Mail has quoted a movie insider who says that the 25th Bond film opens with James Bond, still played by Daniel Craig, being called back from retirement. So while he's still Bond, of course, there's a new 007 at MI5. And that character is apparently played by the British actress Lashana Lynch. Now, Lashana is black and female, so as you'd expect, this story has sparked a lot of chatter on social media. And no doubt, Jason, it's probably also served as a useful bit of publicity for the 25th Bond movie, which, as we've discussed before, has been plagued by a lot of drama during production.
Yeah, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, I wonder how much she has to do with this. I mean, audacious. I look forward to it if it's going to happen. Before you go, let's talk briefly about the new Barbie movie, one of my, you know, must-sees already, I'm sure.
Well, this just has always seemed like such an interesting project.
It is actually, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, a live-action Barbie movie produced in part by the toy company Mattel's new film division. Originally, Barbie was going to be played by Amy Schumer, then Anne Hathaway was attached. But we have known for a while that it's going to be Margot Robbie playing the Barbie. She's also a producer for the project. And now the most surprising twist yet, Jason, the writers for the movie have been named as Greta Gerwig, who wrote Lady Bird, and her partner Noah Baumbach, who wrote Squid and the Whale. So some pretty indie screenwriters for a film about a Barbie doll.
There is. I mean, yes, Baumbach has definitely sort of been around the traps in terms of screenwriting. So I'm really interested. What can I say? Who would have thought? Claire Nichols there with the arts news. My next guest is a producer with over two decades worth of experience. You may not know his name, but you will know the films he has made. He's been behind such movies as Kill Bill 1 and 2, The Kite Runner, and the recent Men in Black movie. He'll be giving an address on Friday, the 26th of July in Adelaide at the Screenmakers Conference. Now, this is a city that's actually featuring pretty heavily in his life because, well, he's moved there and he's gearing up to produce the new Mortal Kombat movie, a sci-fi blockbuster that is reported to be the largest film production in South Australia's history. And he joins me now. His name is E. Bennett Walsh. Hi, Bennett. Welcome to The Screen Show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Now, tell me, how long have you been in Adelaide? Are you used to the city now? Do you walk around like a local?
Well, no, not quite. Only because, you know, we're very busy, so we're spending a lot of time getting the film ready. But we've been on the ground for about 4 weeks, and we're 3 months away from actually filming. We're going to start filming the middle of September.
Now, can you confirm cast at this point? I mean, this is a reboot of I mean, there's a niche audience, I would say, but it's a very passionate niche audience that are really excited about Mortal Kombat, not only the video games, but also the films that have been made. This is being rebooted. What can you tell me about it?
Well, the fortunate thing about Mortal Kombat is that it is such a beloved game, and part of the reason is the characters in it. So we're not going to be so reliant on A-list stars because the characters and the game is so beloved. We don't have our cast quite yet. We've been casting for about 2 months now, and we're probably going to start to make a cast announcement at the end of July, beginning of August.
Now, Simon McQuaid is the director.
That's correct, and he's from Perth.
Now, it got me wondering if there was recently, I think, a very good science fiction dystopian film made in Adelaide, also with the director from Perth, Grant Spatore, and I'm talking about I Am Mother, of course, which people can see on Netflix. It starred Hilary Swank. It was made in Adelaide. Was that film a kind of case study for you to sort of see that you could actually make science fiction in Adelaide?
Unfortunately not. We haven't seen the movie yet, but I think the thing that probably was the calling card was their history, meaning they've been making movies in Adelaide and South Australia, you know, since the 50s, if not even earlier. So there's a genuine enthusiasm, and they've really made really good movies here. So the awareness of and the craft of caring about making movies was part of the reason. Mortal Kombat is the largest movie that's ever been made. And part of that comes is these types of movies have a lot of manufacturing. So a lot of the films that are done here are dramas. I Am Mother is definitely separate. But in this type of film, they're almost the entire wardrobe on everybody's is made from scratch. The sets, obviously, hand props, the set dressing, there's a lot of manufacturing that goes into a fantasy film.
And how many sort of square meters of studio space do you need to make a film like this? I mean,
well, the thing that I've actually thought about this, and I have it in feet, so we're going to have to convert it into meters. But for this type of film, manufacturing, studio, and offices, I need about 100,000 square feet. That's outside of actual locations that we'll be using, but it's about 100,000 square feet of support space.
And so that's for the physical studio space you'll film, but also for the kind of manufacturing areas where you will need to be, you know, making the sets and making the costumes.
That's correct.
It really is competing on a global market, isn't it? We know that there are, you know, sound stages in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, for that matter, in north of the border in Canada that would love a film like this. How competitive has Adelaide been?
Well, I think you point out something that is important, that these types of films do look globally for a home to be made. We are in a time where capacity is an issue throughout the world because there is so much content production. And that's with the streaming services, you know, all sort of opening up and competing. And for the next 5 years, I think we're going to have this sort of boom to production because it is really busy in Australia right now. I think that what Adelaide has is a very well-developed post-production infrastructure. You have two world-class visual effects houses, Rising Sun and The Mill, but you also have smaller houses that have been doing international films like Kojo and Resin. So the one thing that we're looking forward to is when we're doing the movie, we typically are having digital conferences with visual effects houses throughout the world. And here we're going to actually have them in the room when we're talking about the movie. So that's a fortunate thing.
I've always wondered why anyone gets into producing, because it does seem like a life full of logistical headaches and a lot of problems when it comes to managing people. I mean, you're dealing with the fragile egos of directors and actors, and even the more fragile egos, I'd argue, of big money investors too. I mean, what kind of personality traits do you need to produce or executive produce, especially at this level with, you know, multi-million dollar big projects?
Well, I love my job. I describe it to people that I'm sort of the field producer, the day-to-day producer. Once they decide on a director, I'm usually the next person that is on board, and the two of us go off and make the movie. So I find the creative problem solving and crisis intervention, you know, part of the job that I enjoy diving into. Now, how does that come about? I don't know. I think it could have been a scarred childhood, but
I'll do tell. Really,
I did go to 8 schools in 12 years, so that could have added to it. But
And in what sense? That teaches you to kind of make friends, to build alliances, to kind of work out.
And adapt. Yeah. Because I mean, before, you know, I made two movies here 15 years ago. I did Stealth in Sydney and Ghost Rider in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I'm incredibly happy to be back in Australia. I love the place. And Adelaide is proving to be a wonderful city. But before that, I was a year in London and then a year in Budapest and a year and a half in Beijing. So you are on the road a lot. Movies are not made in Los Angeles anymore. And I think...
What percentage are made outside of Los Angeles? Just, sorry to interrupt, but I am curious about that. What do you, in terms of blockbusters?
In feature? Yeah. In terms of, I mean, the last two blockbusters made in Los Angeles was Captain Marvel and Quentin's movie coming out Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, if you consider there are 300 movies being made, not all blockbusters, but that's the percentage of feature films being made.
Mm. So it's in terms of, but at that top level, so you'd say most of the bigger films are made outside of Hollywood now. They're made in Toronto. They're made in Rome. They're made...
They're Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, Atlanta, London, Budapest.
Yeah.
And Australia and New Zealand. Those Australia and New Zealand are production hubs for these types of movies.
You know, when it comes to, you know, dealing with people and the sort of professional relationships that you have, of course, you know, you, like all of us, have been aware of how much the industry was shocked by, you know, the Weinstein case and what resulted from that. The Me Too movement has been a very important thing in recent years. You, of course, had sort of professional relationships with Weinstein, especially, of course, on the Kill Bill pictures. When you look back, I mean, were you as shocked as anyone else? Was there any sense that this behavior was happening, but people were just turning a blind eye?
Well, the thing that is different during this time because it was under Miramax at the time, is that I probably saw Harvey twice on Kill Bill. When you make a Quentin movie, they just let him do what he does best. So it's a very uncommon, you know, Harvey Weinstein experience because I did not have the stories of what he does on other movies. So you don't see, you know, you don't see that sort of behavior when you're doing a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Tarantino.
Whether I was shocked or not, I think it's you know, it's a good thing because I think there are so many people in the industry that cares and that love making movies. And that's what our life is about, is trying to make a story that audiences are going to really enjoy. And that, you know, some people get involved because, oh, it is glamorous. Where's the glamour in movie making? It's at the premiere. That's the only thing. We work 12 to 14 hours a day, sometimes 6 days a week, for a year. Mm. And it's because we're passionate about making these. So when this type of industry attracts people for other reasons, it's unfortunate. So I think it's a good thing.
Was your darkest moment last year when, speaking about Kill Bill 1 and 2, Uma Thurman came out and put responsibility of what she called a cover-up of that footage of the violent car crash that occurred on the set of that film at your feet, but also, of course, Harvey Weinstein and Lawrence Bender. How did you respond to that? I mean, how do you respond now to that? Does the buck stop with you? Do you have to take that on the chin as a producer?
Well, yeah. I mean, a producer takes full responsibility for everything. And it was very unfortunate that the accident happened. We shot 155 days on Kill Bill for the two movies. And the accident happened on day 153. Quentin had come out and told his version of the story, which I think explains it very clearly. But I think that we applied for an insurance claim. The insurance claim was approved and paid, so we were completely transparent. There was none, meaning the car had to be brought back, and we were approved by the insurance company for the claim. So if there was anything, it would have come out there. I think there was a lot of emotion wrapped up into Uma's claim, and hopefully things are better now.
just mentioning Weinstein only briefly again, because I know that he's also, he was, you know, a very powerful producer, and he was famously one to really negotiate hard with directors for Final Cut. I think Tarantino is one of the few where he didn't have that. Correct me if I'm wrong. What's your philosophy as a producer with Final Cut and directors and so forth? Because this is a big philosophical issue, isn't it, really, with filmmaking, and especially big budget filmmaking?
Well, I mean, Quentin did have Final Cut. He did. So it was different. But I like to look at films like literature. Meaning you can have a novel and you can have a trashy magazine and everything in between. So economics play into it, and how much a film costs and how it's going to be released will sort of dictate the stakes at hand. And when you commit to directors, their experience and what they've done needs to be considered. So I think every film has a different sort of matrix to it, and I think it can go anywhere to where it's super important that Martin Scorsese has Final Cut because his vision is so strong. But then if you have a Marvel movie and it's playing into a larger universe with multiple directors, Kevin Feige needs to have Final Cut. So I think it applies differently. It's such a large industry that you just have so many different types of movies that can be considered in different ways.
Thank you very much for joining me on The Screen Show.
Thank you for having me.
E. Bennett Walsh, one of the producers of the big blockbuster being made in Adelaide as we speak. It's in pre-production at the moment. It is the new Mortal Kombat movie. You're listening to The Screen Show. Coming up, the world of streaming, and a warning, there is some strong language ahead.
I'm Robbie, I'm 13, and I'm a thief. These mob love following me around, like I'm famous.
Well, I'm bored and I'm hungry, and I haven't slept for days.
Welcome to my hometown of Alice Springs. It's a shithole. I live in the Shire with my dad. He's a dickhead. But Mum always said, you gotta make the most of what you got.
All right, it's time to welcome in our TV critic, Lauren Carroll Harris, to talk about this beautiful, small little comedy that's streaming on SBS On Demand right now. And from the outset, I should say that, you know, opinions aren't necessarily shared by yours truly or Lauren about Alice Springs. Lovely town.
Yeah. Interesting to hear a little disenfranchised kid's view of it from the grassroots. But yeah, this is Robbie Hood. It's you can hear it's a mischievous, very tender, joyful comedy. I'm really enjoying it. I think it's a really interesting idea, this indigenous reclamation of an old story of the colonizing culture, which is Robin Hood, and taking that into the world of a 13-year-old kid in a dry, tough Alice Springs.
Yeah. Now, look, this has such a pedigree to it. And it's apart from being very good, the pedigree is really interesting to talk about. It's co-written with Cody Bedford, who scripted Mystery Road, the series, last year. Of course, Dylan River, the director, is the son of Warwick Thornton. Now, Dylan was one of the cinematographers. He shot Sweet Country along with his dad. His mum is producer and longtime head of screen territory, Penelope McDonald. His grandmother, and talk about sort of screen royalty in this country, is Frieda Glynn, who's the co-founder of the Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association, CAMA, which was really a talent factory. I mean, it gave us people like, along with Warwick Thornton, Rachel Perkins. So Dylan, I think, is a real talent. You can, you know, he's a filmmaker who stands on his own two feet. someone, how do you rate him? I think he's someone who's going to go on and make films.
Exactly. He has a vision. He has a sensibility. He's going to make a body of work. And what we're seeing is not just this really great black dynasty of storytellers, but 25 years of cultural policy supporting Indigenous ideas on screen.
Yeah.
And what Robbie Hood shows is that Dylan Rivers is a great visual storyteller. And what I mean by that is that it doesn't just have really gorgeous kind of travelogue, you know, cutaways to the trees and the skies around Alice Springs.
All of which are beautiful.
Very, very pretty. But that the story happens visually. You see it unfold visually. You know, in old school TV, I think the story happened through dialogue. You know, characters were always telling you what happened last week on the show, what they felt in their hearts, what was going to happen next, that exposition-based storytelling. This is completely different. Robbie Hood's very laconic. There's very little dialogue, but very cleverly edited and set to this melancholic, lonesome country and Western music, which it turns out is played by Robbie's dad, who's still grieving the death of Robbie's mum.
Now, the dad's white.
The dad's a white fella,
and
that's
and he's a good for nothing. He can sing, yeah. He plays a guitar well. Yeah. But that's an interesting dynamic in there are two interesting dynamics in this series, which are each ep's about 10 minutes, yeah, and there's six of them.
Yeah.
One of the dynamics is Robbie Hood and his little gang of mates, this really tall,
yeah,
this little as Johnny. A silhouette, this, yeah, yeah, there's a very tall kid, a short,
a tomboy, yeah, she's great.
And they wander around the landscape together, but also there's this fraught relationship with the father.
Yeah, and what that's about, I think, is that there's no guidelines for children in how to deal with slightly wayward parents. So to me, it really reminded me of Taika Waititi's work and the description that, you know, Taika Waititi makes sad comedies and funny tragedies. I think that's what's happening here. You know, it's kind of a comedy about child neglect.
Yeah.
And there's this real sense of trauma. But
the children are quite resourceful, which I think is quite interesting.
And they're optimistic.
Yes.
I mean, they're stealing because they're hungry. So, but they're
but
also
stealing. It's not that sort of, it's not this amoral story. There's a morality to it. There's one point where the Robbie Hood character actually says, no, we're not taking that. That's not right. There's a sense of justice through it,
and
like Robin Hood had, right?
That's what childhood is like. Yeah. Kids do have a sense of unfairness. Like, that's not fair. That's not right. And, you know, some of the humour here is coming from the darkness of, like, 13-year-olds cussing, like, very heavily. But a lot of it, you know, yeah, they're very resourceful, and each episode is structured so that it ends in a small victory for the kids. You know, like, there's always a moment of transcendence.
It's beautifully made. I mean, you know, it reminded me a little bit of Tumala Ivan Sen's film.
Yes,
which
I
think is one of his
it's
best.
It's set in Alice Springs in a town. Like, it's not a Western desert kind of story, which I think we've seen a lot of.
And the tone's a little different from Tumala. Was a little bleaker, I would argue, and a little more jagged. And this is kind of a little bit sweeter.
It's sweeter. But as you say, there is this sense of injustice seen through a child's eyes. I think this is a very interesting way to think about how racism operates in Australia, a society of pretty entrenched racist injustice, and the hurt of that, how that feels to Robbie. What would it feel like if all the, you know, people of authority in your life were always speaking down to you, not letting you get into the pool in summer? And that's such a great convention of kids' shows and kids' movies.
Of course, Aboriginal storytelling too, the pool, the small town pool. But I will say, though, that it's not didactic. I mean, people shouldn't get the wrong impression. I was really surprised. This is the best web series I've seen that I can sort of recall, really, of recent times. It's really a standout. The visual storytelling, as you say, is great. And this character, this young character, Robbie Hood, is so charismatic.
Yeah, I'd say that Padraea Jackson is a very sensitive, intelligent, watchful performer. You know, he's always kind of casting his eyes around and watching what the adults are doing next.
And he loves this, excuse the dated term, but this checkout chick called Mim. The faces in this are amazing. They're kind of, they remind me of early Italian post-war cinema and the sorts of faces you'd see there. I mean, you get Mim and you're just going, what an extraordinary looking
performer. Yeah, because these are real kids. It's taken from the texture of real life. You know, the cost of meat in this supermarket is, you know, $70, for a rack of lamb. You know, only the cops can afford the meat. And, you know, this idea of like small dramas playing out in in a kind of really interesting little community of kids growing up in the absence of grown-ups in their lives. So the trio of friends at the core has a really beautiful sense of kinship.
Mm.
And I really love this father-son relationship, this idea that the white fella dad is, he's not evil, he's just hopeless and he's just kind of incapable. And that really does illustrate the humour of the show. I think Dylan Rivers' direction really deepens the sadness and the humour at the same time, so that the saddest moments of the show are the funniest. And when people say, oh, that's how comedy and pathos work together, you know, like they're two sides of the same coin, I actually disagree. I think often the way that it works is that the funniest moments come out of the saddest ones.
They're right there, yeah, coexisting.
Exactly.
On
they're mingled. And so this is my favourite bit of the whole show that I wanted to share with you. It's this conversation between the father and son. I want you to imagine what it would be like for little Robbie being asked by your father on Christmas Day if you had enough money to bail him out of jail.
You mob gonna bail me out or what?
No money.
Was Grandma got any money?
No.
Fair enough.
How about I teach you how to play guitar when I get out of here? Yeah, that's what I'll do. I love you, mate. I do.
Love you too, Dad.
My mum always said to stand up for people who can't stand up for themselves. Like Dad, he's a bit of a dickhead, but he ain't that bad.
Yeah, that's Robbie Hood on SBS On Demand. I think this is one of the strongest Australian TV shows since Blackadder. I really like it that much, and it surprised me. I didn't think.
And there are some sort of riotous bits in it too, some really funny bits. I like when the kids break into the house of the drug dealer and they think he's a scientist.
And
that's a beautiful, beautifully shot thing in this dark garage as well. Anyway, look, before you go, Lauren, what's on your watch list for the next week?
I really was into Big Little Lies. I still am, despite the scandal surrounding director Andrea Arnold's loss of creative control. And I can't wait to talk about it more with you next week, actually.
Yes. I sense a pretty big conversation happening. Yeah, it ends next week, so we will...
We need to break that down.
We need to break that down. All right, break it down. Thank you much, Lauren. That was great. And I'll see you next week. Lauren Carol Harris, our resident TV critic on the screen. Actually, before you go, Lauren, it's time to go, but we're going to go out on Hakuna Matata again. And you actually have a weird
factoid. Oh, strong family connection, for real. Yeah, my brother has a Hakuna Matata tattoo. I don't know if he recalls getting it. It was a spontaneous decision on a holiday to Southeast Asia, as is the custom for Anglo-Australians.
Okay, so we'll go out on that. That's goodbye, though. Until next week, from
thanks,
me, Jason DeRosso, and Lauren Carol Harris. See you next week on The Screen Show.
Well, kid.
Oh, well, Hakuna Matata. Slimy, yet satisfying.
That's it. It means no worries for the rest of your day.
Hakuna Matata. Hakuna Matata.
Matata.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.